The next case is zero. The next case in our calendar is 09605, State of Ohio versus Douglas Prade. Justice O'Connor has recused herself from this case, and we're very pleased to have sitting in place of Justice O'Connor, Judge Patricia Delaney, who is a judge in the Court of Appeals in the 5th District. Welcome, Judge Delaney. Mr. Alden.
Mr. Chief Justice, if it pleases the Court, I'm David Alden. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes, if I could, Your Honor.
Your time there.
I represent Douglas Prade. He's a former Akron police captain. He was convicted in 1998 of the aggravated murder of his then-ex-wife, Dr. Margot Prade. Dr. Prade was murdered in her minivan in a parking lot. The murderer sat across from her in the passenger seat, and she attempted to defend herself. She shoved her arm in the murderer's mouth so hard that he bit her. He bit her through two layers of clothing, her lab coat on the outside and her blouse on the inside. He bit her so hard that it left a bite mark on her skin. At trial in 1998, three experts testified about that bite mark on her skin. The two experts for the state testified that that mark was either made by Mr. Prade or, alternatively, that it was consistent with Mr. Prade's dentition. The defense put on an expert who said that, given the loose-fitting nature of his dentures, Mr. Prade simply couldn't have made that bite mark. There was also DNA testing of the lab coat over the bite mark in 1998. That lab testing was done using the polymerase chain reaction, or PCR for short, testing method. And that, in 1998, was the state-of-the-art testing method. But the testing method used in 1998 really didn't tell us much. All it found was that the blood on the lab coat over the bite mark was Dr. Prade's. It effectively identified the murder victim as having been present at her own murder. That meant precious little in terms of the trial. The DNA evidence was a non-starter in this trial. It meant literally nothing.
Didn't that DNA test, though, exclude your client?
Several DNA tests did exclude my client, and they were, but as I will get to later, Your Honor, there are exclusions and then there are exclusions. The exclusion on the bite mark testing, the lab coat over the bite mark excluded Mr. Prade. It excluded him in the sense that the blood was definitely Dr. Prade's. So that was one exclusion. There were other exclusions. There were scrapings under her fingernails that, while I think some were traced to Dr. Prade, others were traced or were untraceable. So there were several exclusions in 1998. But the critical fact and the thing that both courts below missed was that there are exclusions and then there are exclusions.
And you're going to be arguing the non-definitive nature of those, I would assume.
I am, Your Honor. Okay. Thank you. I'll get there. I'm sorry. I'm so slow. Since 1998, DNA testing technology has moved on. PCR is no longer used. There are two new methods used. One is short tandem repeat, or STR. The other is Y-chromosome short tandem repeat, or YSTR. Unlike the 1998 testing that, as the state's own expert testified at this trial, he basically said, I can't tell anything because there's so much blood here. And the blood from the victim overwhelms my ability to find anything else. Well, the new technologies address that problem. The new technologies can find a small amount of male DNA within a vast amount of female DNA. And that's the YSTR. It looks for the male Y chromosome. And it can detect things that in 1998 simply couldn't be detected. Mr. Prade, in his application here, asked simply that the new testing technologies be used on, among other things, the lab coat and the other physical evidence collected from the trial. And even though he offered to pay for that for free, the trial court denied his application, and the Court of Appeals affirmed.
Mr.
He does risk, doesn't go to our legal issue here, but he does risk, if we were to reverse, and which consequence would be that there'd be a new, more sophisticated test, he could be implicated, could he not?
He risks that. I mean, of course he could, Your Honor. The tests will show what the tests will show.
He's not in much worse condition, I guess, than he is now, because he's been convicted on other evidence, but at least he's willing to make that gamble.
He is fully committed. He has never confessed to the crime. He's never made any admissions. There's no post-conviction confession here. So he certainly is at risk for the science showing what the science shows. And it will show what it will show if the testing goes forward.
Mr. Alden, it seems rather unusual because in a situation where a defendant is asking for a test, there has been some suggestion that there is, you know, evidence that this is the individual. But right now you have all the tests saying your client is not, there is no DNA. So you're asking for another test to repeat what is already shown. Is that what you're doing?
No, what we're really asking for is a better test. I mean, effectively, the tests that have been done to date are as if there was no testing. The test on the lab coat over the bite mark showed nothing. And given the inherent limitations of 1998 technology, it could show nothing. They knew going in they were not going to find anything except the blood, and that's what they found. What we're saying is those exclusion results are based on outmoded technology, and if you use new technology, you would get different, or you may well get, and only the science will show what the science will show, but you may well get a new exclusion result because we have an entirely new capability that we did not have in 1998. And so the old exclusion results are really meaningless because they're done with old technology that simply lacked the capacity to find the DNA from the murderer's saliva.
But you would find anything different in regard to the blood itself? Or are you
I'm sure the blood,
focusing on the saliva, which apparently was never really tested because it couldn't because of the blood?
I don't think we're going to find different blood. I think the blood test from 1998 was right. It found, so far as I know, it found Dr. Prade's blood, and there's every reason to have expected her blood to have been in that car.
Okay, so it's the saliva then that you're attempting to test, and your argument is essentially it never was tested the first time because it was not possible to do so.
Exactly, Your Honor. And maybe that's a better way than I've been putting it, that as to the relevant biological evidence here, which is the killer's DNA from the saliva left in the bite mark or anywhere else. I mean, there is other physical evidence, but the one that we're focusing on is the lab coat over the bite mark. But as to the killer's DNA from the killer's saliva in the bite mark, we have no results.
Counsel, if we reverse the Court of Appeals and allow tests to go forward, or the test that you're requesting, and you're indicating science has advanced to the point that they can pick up DNA markers that they couldn't previously pick up. Is that correct?
We believe it has, yes. And actually the state's experts said that.
All right.
Yes.
And let's take it a step further. They find DNA markers is in a specific place. Is the request narrowed to a particular fabric? What all are you asking to be tested?
I'm not an expert in DNA testing, so I speak with some ignorance here. But I know enough, I think, to answer
the
question.
You're speaking to a choir of folks who are in the same position.
First of all, we don't have this evidence. Only the state has it. Presumably, it's been preserved. It was divided. The way they do it is they cut it, and there were cuttings, and they're identified in the.
So these are all off of the lab coat that you're looking at, or could it be from the vehicle as well? Or
there are only about 20 of them. And
so everything for which a sample is preserved, you want a new test.
That it would make sense.
All right. And so let's assume that that's done. And additional DNA is turned up that's not hers and is not his. Where does that get you?
Depends on where it is and whose it is and how much you know about it.
So you turn up DNA that's not hers and not his. Then the next thing is you try to search for to see if you can find whose DNA that is.
That would be one approach you could take.
And that could be the DNA of somebody else who had been in the vehicle at some time appropriately. So it doesn't necessarily lead you anywhere.
Several results would not necessarily lead you anywhere. I would submit that a result of male DNA inside the bite mark that the killer slobbered on the lab coat, inside the bite mark, over the bite mark that the killer slobbered on, an appreciable amount of male DNA there.
But, counsel, wasn't the evidence in this case that there was no saliva present on the lab coat where the bite mark was?
Actually, they did a preliminary test where they found it, and then on a more sophisticated test, they could not find enough using 1998 technology. However, the state's DNA testing expert said in their report in the trial court, and if I could get it, I'll quote it, and this was based on not her review of the evidence again, but her review of the report that you're talking about. I believe that YSTR testing has the potential to identify any male DNA that might be contained within the lab coat bite mark sample.
But that DNA could have come from another source other than the biter, correct?
Theoretically, anything is possible, of course, Your Honor.
Well, if that's possible, how could you have an outcome determinative conclusion here if the source of the DNA is not from the biter?
Because I don't think that that's at all likely. I mean, if we had to engage in the speculation that only DNA that can be definitively tied to a known murderer is something that can exonerate something, I don't think we'd bother with much DNA testing. I mean, what you have to do is look at the particular evidence that you're testing, which here is evidence that is likely to have been DNA evidence from the killer.
And if you have a woman wearing a lab coat that certainly, we don't know if she wore it every day, when the last time it was washed. Isn't this very speculative on your part to think that that lab coat would only contain the DNA of either the killer or the victim?
Not when there was testimony at trial that the killer probably slobbered all over the lab coat, and not when the state's expert at trial said that he thought that the best place to find the killer's DNA would be on the lab coat.
But the only evidence it's my understanding the lab report did not indicate the presence of saliva on the lab coat.
I think there was a preliminary positive test, and then there was a second test, and the second test did not find it using 1998 technology. But the fact that a saliva test is not a DNA test. A saliva test is one that they do to try to hone in on the testing to test the right part of the DNA. A saliva test does not mean that there's no DNA there.
Mr. Alden, the Court of Appeals never addressed that outcome determinative issue, did it?
Well, it's actually hard to tell what the Court of Appeals did with the outcome determinative issue. They focused overwhelmingly on the prior determinative test, and they found that because of the prior determinative test, the outcome determinative issue was moot. But then they said, here, we think that yet another exclusion result. But that was all they said.
Well, they declined to address it, really. They did say it was moot, and then they didn't do anything with it. Why shouldn't we let them make the determination in the first instance rather than have our court do something? I mean, if we agree with you, why should we go wading into that?
I'm sorry. I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, following up on what Judge Delaney was talking about, the fact is we only order this if it's going to be outcome determinative, right?
If it may be, yes.
And there's been no ruling by that by the lower court.
Correct. And I think if you were to reverse here, you would have to send it back, and the lower court would then have to follow the statutory procedure, including that. Yet the lower court on the outcome determinative issue here ruled, as I recall, that any result would merely duplicate. That's clearly erroneous because that assumes that you're going to not get any. I mean, if you had, you can't assume a negative result and ever have DNA testing.
It seems to me the essence of the case is that all the testing that was available was favorable to your client, in other words, excluding your client. But nobody could really have the, they didn't have the scientific ability to test saliva So that was not tested. It was not separated out. It still exists as a DNA possibility, and you have three outcomes. Either you can identify DNA in the saliva, which circumstantially makes it pretty probable that the killer put the saliva there. I don't think other people go around slobbering on lab coats in a lab without that attach it. You match it with somebody else and try to build your case around that. You don't match it, which makes your case much harder to overturn. It's your client's, which ends your case, or there's no sufficient DNA to test, which ends your case. But the first outcome could be outcome determinative, it seems, if they do find enough DNA in the saliva to test.
Exactly, Your Honor.
It seems to be the essence of your case, is you're saying you want that chance to test something that didn't really ever get tested because the technology didn't exist. Is that an accurate summation?
It is, Your Honor.
And that's a statutory interpretation issue that we have, I think, here on the definitive DNA. The statute's written pretty broad, but it could be argued it's written for the benefit of the defendant only and not to determine whether someone else committed the crime. That's just one way to view it. Your argument certainly is that the language doesn't confine it to excluding or including the defendant who's seeking the test. It's a little different case than most of them, even different than most of the cases that have been cited, where DNA has been used to exonerate persons who sometimes are in prison. Here he's already been excluded, but by a test that, as you argue, is not really definitive because it couldn't be in view of comparing it to today's science. I think that's the first issue for us, and if we get by that one and say that it was not definitive, that a new test would be, it could be, then the outcome determinative issue is the second issue. And I suppose there, if you get a good DNA sample from the saliva, that can be tested with the FBI's network. As you know, that they've got that huge database of persons, criminals' DNAs from all over the country, and that would be one source of trying to track. You know, it's like looking for a needle in a haystack, but it's been used very successfully in many instances.
Your Honor.
Is that essentially where we are with this case, as you see it?
I believe it is. I mean, effectively, our position is, yes, we had testing. The testing by today's standard pales in comparison, and it really tells us nothing. If we were to do new testing, as it would be if you were tried today, if we were to do new testing, we would get new results, we hope.
I suppose it wasn't even definitive as to your client, because it's possible that the saliva could be his. You argue, obviously, that it wasn't. There isn't. But even to that extent, it's not. He's arguing, it's somebody else, and new DNA tests can maybe lead us to the real killer. But it wasn't even definitive as to him. It looks on the face of it that it was, because he's excluded. But he's excluded by a test that is not, by today's standards, is not definitive.
A test that lacked the capacity to find the saliva DNA.
Right.
But, Mr. Alden, there were two eyewitnesses that testified at trial, were there not? Identified your client as being present?
There were two eyewitnesses. One was who saw this is actually a strange. Can I answer the question, Your Honor?
Yeah, sure.
I know I'm over my time. This entire murder was taped by a security camera next door, and the tape was reconstructed because it wasn't the focus of it. And they did track down someone who was standing in the parking lot and saw the car that the murderer got away in drive by. And so there was one witness who was standing in the parking lot, and after the fact they found him, and he said that he saw a man with a hat. Well, actually, if his testimony evolved, he was interviewed twice without implicating Mr. Parade at all. He didn't implicate Mr. Parade until February. So that's one witness. The other witness was someone who worked at the car dealership where the security tape was made, Mr. Husk. And he didn't come forward for 9 months in the most highly publicized trial in Akron in certainly the last decade or two. I mean, if you look at the law review article we cite in our brief, There are 200 cases of DNA exonerations, and they have a chart at the end of it of the evidence that on which these people were convicted in the first instance. And I was looking at it last night, and there are easily 150 of them that have eyewitness testimony where DNA testing later shows that the eyewitnesses were simply wrong.
But wasn't there a tally also of the debts that your client had that would have been paid by the insurance proceeds? Wasn't that part of the evidence as well?
There was a bank receipt dated from October
before the
correct
incident.
And I have bank receipts in my house right now dated from many months ago, and anything I wrote on them doesn't mean that I wrote it on the date that I went to the bank. I mean, frankly, there's no evidence. The money problems issue, which that relates to, the money problems were Dr. Prade. She hadn't paid her taxes. When she'd stopped being an employee somewhere, she stopped doing withholding for like 2 years. And they had a deep federal tax hole that was hers. And he did write on that bank slip in a way to allocate the life insurance proceeds. But there was no evidence that he wrote on that bank slip before the November 26th murder.
Thank you.
You've used your time, Mr. Alder.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Cassay.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court, Richard Cassay, representing the State of Ohio in this case. I want to address briefly the last question posed to counsel about the notations on the bank check deposit slip. Now, Margot Prade was killed.
Well, counsel, let me take you to what we're here about instead of retrying the case this morning. Those things are in your brief, and it's interesting because your statement of facts and the appellant's statement of facts hardly recognize the same. Okay, so you tell us a lot more about why he was convicted. My question is, if there's new technology available, what's the harm in allowing this test to be done?
Well, counsel indicated that the DNA test that was done on the bite mark material did not tell us much. Now, I believe that YSTR testing, although it is a new technology, it is a great advance in many respects over the technology of the past. You know, I'd be worse than foolish to try to tell you otherwise. We have used it. Our office have used it ourselves. But when we look at the specific facts of the case and what would be relevant here, as I think we must, then we have to focus on the word that's been bandied about here several times by both counsel for Mr. Prade and members of this court, and that word is saliva. It's my position that unless the new DNA test, whether it be YSTR, short tandem repeat STRs, or whatever test might come down the pike, unless that test can identify saliva as opposed to other DNA that might be on that lab coat over, around, or near the bite mark, then that particular DNA test is not going to tell us anything different.
Well, we might all agree with that, but what if it can? What if the test can find saliva residue and get a DNA profile from that? What's the harm in finding that out?
There's no proof in this record that YSTR can do that, Your Honor. Now, what I did, I reread every word of the DNA application,
it would seem to me with every DNA test, you wouldn't know until you did it whether or not you're going to find anything more.
Well, no, I have to respectfully disagree, because the issue is, can the DNA test discriminate enough to separate, to say this is DNA from saliva, or this is DNA from my thumb, which I've just left on this podium. That's the issue. Or that's so, a DNA test.
So you're saying if they find DNA in the area of the coat, it could be a child's DNA or anybody that came in contact with the doctor that got there before the bite occurred.
Certainly.
And so you believe the whole test, the whole case turns on whether or not there's any evidence that the new tests are capable of detecting a DNA result that comes from saliva.
Well, that's the way, yes, because that's the way this case is being argued and has been presented. We've heard the killer slobbered on the coat. Saliva over and over and over, and in the briefs, the clear implication is, I'll give counsel that the YSTR can discriminate between saliva and any other form of DNA.
Well, let's look at this in a real practical sense. If you bite somebody, I think you can just common sense assume there's going to probably be some saliva left. Okay? Is that pretty easy to understand?
I will accept that, yes,
okay.
Ma'am.
Okay. And if you do the sampling, let's say we allow it, and you do the sampling, and it comes up with DNA, you may or may not be able to prove it's definitively from saliva, but now you've got DNA in a spot mixed with the blood. That's significant to some degree, isn't it?
No, because what we're talking about is a lab coat.
Well, you're not likely to have just casual DNA from a touch in concentrations enough to touch as you are to get concentrations enough from saliva.
That's a supposition that you're
well,
making.
Okay, we'll let the experts debate that. But then you test it and you run it through the bank, the FBI bank, and you come up with a killer. That's one possibility.
Mm-hmm.
You test it, can't tell whose DNA it is, you really probably don't have any change in your case, correct? You test it, and it's his. Now you're done, correct?
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that the testing in many cases with eyewitness testimony like you have here ends up with not a match or a match with another known killer, why wouldn't we allow this to happen? Why wouldn't we favor the whole idea of allowing DNA testing when you have not had DNA testing of this male chromosome or this male DNA? You have not had that, so you can't say it's conclusive or inconclusive as to him because it hasn't been done, correct?
It has not been done.
Okay.
Counsel.
Mr. Cassay, could I ask about the statute? Because I'm trying to look at this for in general rather than for the specific case right now. With respect to the statute 2953-74, it says that if there's an application and there's been a prior definitive DNA test, then the court shall reject the application. I mean, that's pretty strong language, but the statute does not define what definitive DNA test is. And if I listen to opposing counsel here, he's almost suggesting that science being what it is, always advancing, always perfecting itself, how can we say that there's ever going to be a definitive DNA test when, science is going to become better at testing anything?
Under the current statute, you probably could never have a definitive test because the natural progression of science is that it improves. So it would be difficult to say at any one point this is definitive because a month later somebody could make some advance and then we don't have definitive anymore.
So then we just read out that first sentence that says the court shall reject any application?
One thing this case does, I think it does in any event, is present the court with an opportunity to define what a definitive test is under the current statutes. Because as the Ninth District, I think, correctly said, The current statute does not have a definition of a definitive test.
But if you've conceded that this DNA has never been tested, this saliva DNA or just whatever male DNA is in mixed with the blood has not been tested because it was overwhelmed by the blood under the old technology, then how is that a definitive test when it has not been tested?
It's not. Getting back to the specific facts of the case, and I apologize if that's where I'm being pulled here. It would not be definitive because there's no showing that the YSTR can do what would be relevant in this case. If we do a YSTR and we turn up male DNA, which is certainly a possibility, what does that mean? Does that mean, and it's not Douglas Prades?
Well, here's, I think, the problem that you're resisting, and you tell me if I'm wrong about your principal reason for resisting this. If they can get some DNA indication from the lab coat where the bite occurred, and as Justice Stratton said, the experts can argue back and forth whether it's from saliva or not, but let's say they get it and it does not implicate the defendant, it's not his, but you don't know whose it is, that where that leads you probably is to a retrial because of the experts who said those were his teeth marks at that point, or you've got a problem with other evidence in the case at that point. Isn't that where it would put you?
Your hypothetical, Your Honor, I think is premised on the supposition that the DNA that would be located hypothetically would be from the killer. And I don't know that we can make that leap or conclusion or that inference is reasonable.
Right, you're going to argue about all of that.
But it
muddies the water at that point, that's for sure.
Well, yes, but muddying the water is, I hope, not what the statute is designed to do. Even if there is DNA located, and based on this record, we don't know where it would come from, forget about who, but what type of DNA it is, then you still have to run that through the outcome determinative part of the statute. And there, I think, you get what the Court of Appeals and the trial court said here. Essentially, how many exclusions does Douglas Prade want?
So the key is going to have to be, as you started out with, the scientists are going to not only have to say we found DNA in the area of the bite mark, but it's DNA that was acquired from saliva.
I think that
if they can do all of that, then the defendant has a shot at a new trial, but failing to show that not only did they find male DNA there, but they found it from saliva in the area of the bite mark. If they don't do that, they're nowhere.
I don't want to be sounding like I'm unreasonable here. We're not trying to hold
on. But that's your position, isn't it? And
saliva is the key in this case.
Yeah.
I don't think you can get around that.
The Court of Appeals talk about saliva that much?
They mentioned the SRI report, and I think that's highly relevant, too. This was the report done for defense counsel, and they tested a lab coat cutting. Now, I can't tell you which one because there were several, but the lab coat cutting they tested, preliminarily they found amylase activity amylase is principally found in saliva. Then when they did test it again, they did not find any saliva activity. So you have two things, in my view. Number one, you don't have any even allegation. You have an assertion, but you don't have anything based on any evidence that YSTR can discriminate like I think it needs to discriminate. And number two, to the extent there's anything in the record, there's no saliva, at least on one portion of that bite mark.
Why do you need the saliva so much? Why isn't just finding DNA sufficient? Because if you, like I said, you've got three outcomes. His DNA, you're done. Don't know whose it is, you're probably no different physician. Get a DNA and you can match it to the FBI bank and find somebody else. And the fact that it's in the site of the bite, you don't need the saliva itself. There's sufficient circumstantial evidence otherwise, isn't there?
A defendant says we need, Mr. Prade, Douglas Prade, is saying the saliva is the key. I think it is too. Again, if there's something there, then that result.
But the saliva itself doesn't prove anything because you can't identify it without a DNA marker, correct?
If you have to
have the DNA identify whose it belongs to. Saliva can't be identified as far as I understand.
You can identify. Now, I'm not the expert either, Your Honor, and I don't pretend to be. But if they find DNA, then the question is going to arise: from what source of from a human body is that DNA originating from? Now,
is it a reasonable inference that male DNA in the site of the bite mark could become come from whoever bit him? Is that a reasonable inference
yes.
a jury could draw?
Yes, it could be.
Okay. What principle of law would I voted to allow this case because I thought it was really a very important case because we're going to have more DNA cases coming. The courts are going to have more DNA cases confronting them. What rule of law would you have us write in this case that would help prosecutors, defense counsel, and judges know how to apply 0.74.
Well, in my view, it really couldn't be an overarching proposition of law because, as I've tried to argue here, I think you need to look at the specific facts of the case to determine whether or not a test using new technology would be definitive or not.
So in your view, there's no reason to confine the words prior definitive DNA test to the science at the time and to say that's fixed.
I'm not quarreling with the idea that a new DNA test that did not exist however many years ago the initial DNA tests were done should not be looked at or used or considered under the statute. But I think if you want to do that, I think you need to have something to base a fair inference on that the result you're going to get with the new test is going to be relevant in the case.
The problem that everybody is having, though, is the Court of Appeals determined that the initial DNA test was a definitive test,
mm-hmm.
and the result is definitive. The argument seems to be, if I understand Mr. Alden, the science has advanced, and it really wasn't definitive because it didn't show anything. And yet the Court of Appeals rejects the argument that the defendant is advancing. These results aren't definitive. And that seems to be the issue that confronts us.
It could be definitive if, based on proper proof, it could be.
Is it your view that the initial DNA test is or is not definitive?
The initial DNA test on the bite mark?
Yes.
Based on what I know now, I would still say it is definitive.
Based on what?
Based on any evidence that the YSTR can turn up what's really relevant in this case.
What that doesn't go to definitive. That goes to outcome determinative, doesn't it?
Thank you.
Definitive goes to the question of the test that was administered. And the test here, and you know better than I, in most DNA cases, there's one sample or two samples. There's no question about whether it's definitive or not. They test it pursuant to standard testing methods, and people are convicted or not convicted based on that. Here we have a test that it seems to me, from what I read in the briefs, that everyone agrees was not definitive at the time because it could not detect, because of the blood cover, could not detect saliva or perhaps other DNA. Isn't that why it's not definitive because there's a new test? It was not definitive at the time because it couldn't test everything.
A definition of a definitive test that would state that a test is not definitive if later a new test comes along that could reveal what the initial test did not, that would fit that example.
Well, we have both issues. Here we have if the first test had detected DNA on every bit of material that the investigators had, and it was definitive as to the defendant, not as to anyone else, but as to him, and then a new test is developed years later, that's the second issue, whether that second test then could overrule, I guess, the first test. But we have two legal issues on how to apply the statute. Do you agree?
Put that way, yes.
Would it help to say...
You don't have to agree.
Would it help to say that definitive involves a positive identification of someone? I mean, here we have the potential of exclusion, but we don't have a positive identification. And definitive, I know the statute doesn't help us by... They do define outcome determinative, but they don't define definitive.
Right.
And the word in common parlance would suggest, you know, it's been established, this is it. A positive identification of someone appears to me to be to be definitive.
That would be one definition that, again, without just saying it just for the purpose of agreeing, that that's reasonable.
Well, counsel, I'm lost in how many different definitions you might have said could be acceptable. Let me bring you back to...
I'll be glad to restate what
I
think.
Well, I think you were saying that if a new test is developed that everybody agrees may make it possible to discern DNA information that was from the same material that was previously tested, that it was not scientifically able to be revealed the first time around, then and there's a new test that has the potential for revealing new information, then the old test under the statutory language would no longer be definitive. It was definitive at the time. It is no longer definitive. Is that a fair statement of the way you view it? Or
yes, with the caveat that the new information would have to be
relevant.
On its face relevant to the
right.
To the case under the specific facts of the case.
Okay. Mr. Cassay, then, this case was not decided initially based on the DNA determination. And it was a circumstantial case, right?
Yes.
The circumstantial evidence was coming from two eyewitnesses and the debt tabulation on the bank receipt.
Well, there was a multitude of circumstantial evidence. Now, I can...
But that's what the case was.
Yes. All the DNA tests that could be done... excluded Douglas Prade. That's the fingernail clippings, really the fingernail clippings, because the blood and, you know, the state's expert Callahan testified.
And I guess that's my point. As I come back to the legal issue confronted by the Ninth District when they reviewed this. Since the initial test excluded him, if from a DNA standpoint of evidence, an additional test, even if it were favorable and excluded him, doesn't change any of the circumstantial evidence, and that's why the debt tabulation on the bank receipt and the eyewitness testimony, among others, become relevant. Is that a fair characterization of the case?
Yes, because the definition of outcome determinativeness includes all admissible evidence, plus the effect of an exclusion of any DNA test that would be ordered by the court.
What would be the effect of, do you think, say there's a new DNA test and it detects saliva or whatever, DNA of a person who worked for the doctor in her home and had a little scuffle with her, dispute over something, and it identified it was his DNA, would that change the circumstantial evidence? I think the circumstantial evidence here is really circumstantial, particularly with the ID evidence, as we know, that sometimes is not terribly reliable. But would that change?
If there was,
and I can add some more facts to it. Obviously, he killed someone 3 months ago. Isn't that what we really have to think about when we decide whether it's outcome determinative? It appears that maybe it isn't on its face, wouldn't be, but it also may be.
I will go back to what I said initially, Your Honor, and there's nothing inconsistent with what you just said. If we have a DNA test that can discriminate to the level of saliva, fine. If we had that right now, if we knew, if the Summit County Prosecutor's Office knew, and we've announced this, that if we had a test that could discriminate to saliva, we'll test. And we've already announced it, and I'm saying it here. We have not been shown that.
Thank you, Mr. Cassay.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Alden, we've taken you well beyond your time, too, but start with a minute.
I really have only 2 points. I was a history major and an economics major, and I'm not a very good scientist.
I can't hear you.
I'm sorry. I was a history major and an economics major, and I'm not a scientist. But the state's expert below, who is a scientist and is a PhD, in fact, said, I believe that YSTR testing has the potential to identify any male DNA that might be contained within the lab coat of the bite mark sample. That's their expert. Our expert said the same thing. As to whether we might find something here, I think that's pretty clear.
Well, Mr. Cassay is saying, though, the test may have stepped up to the point that you can find DNA that got on the lab coat for any multiple number of innocent reasons, and that to make a difference in this case, you would need to show that it came from the saliva in the area of the bite mark.
You'd need a significant concentration or a concentration consistent with it having been saliva. The other thing that my non-scientific understanding is there's no such thing as a saliva DNA test. You either right. test it for DNA or you test it for saliva, and what they use saliva tests for is to find where they should test for DNA, because DNA, as I understand it, is DNA. My only other point was in response to Justice Lanzinger's concern that I'm trying to convince you to go down a slippery slope, that every time some new chemistry student develops a new, slightly different technique, all the prisoners in Ohio's jails get new testing. And that's certainly not what I'm asking you to do. And I think, at least on the facts of this case, where you've had a complete discarding of the technology that was used in 98 and a replacement by not one but two entirely new techniques, we don't have the slippery slope problem. The testing here clearly was outdated, and as applied to these facts, although maybe not to all facts, but as applied to these facts, these were not definitive tests.
Counsel, I have a sort of a background question here on the statute. I'm assuming anybody can test their DNA if they want to test their DNA, and you don't have to apply to the court to get it, but because this is an inmate, and because the evidence is held by the state, is that why you have to get a court order to test the DNA? The prosecutor's office won't turn over the lab coat voluntarily to get a, because you offered to pay for it. It's not going to be at their expense. But they won't turn it over so that you can test it on your own, so you have to get a court order, or are there other consequences? that while you're going through the need to go through the court and follow the statute.
We you certainly don't need a if you have the evidence, you don't need a court order to do the DNA testing. On the other hand, you've just touched on a completely separate and very interesting issue that kind of got lost in the way along the way, which is the Ohio statute expressly in section 295384 says it's not the exclusive method to get testing. So at least in theory, there may be other methods through which convicted inmates can get testing, whereas here it was selected from a group and somebody's willing to pay for it. Frankly, the trial court never even addressed that, and the Court of Appeals said that it rejected that based on a waiver. So he did ask for kind of independent of the statute testing, which the statute, as it was amended in 06, clearly contemplates, but there really are no procedures, and I've never seen it done. And honestly, it's a brave new world, and I don't have instruction for you.
You, on behalf of your client, didn't ask the prosecutor's office, can we go test that lab coat here and just work out our own arrangement for doing that? That process weren't followed, just filed in court.
There may have been those. Your Honor, I was brought in on the appeal, and those conversations very well may have occurred. I would be surprised if trial counsel did not first approach the prosecutor's office and get told to go to court. But I don't know that.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Alden. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.